Now
on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday Morning Update.
Good morning. It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jeff Wolf is behind the console. Jane Houghton and our producer this morning. And a big story broke last night. You wouldn't know it if you were following CNN. They spent the 5 o'clock hour and totally ignored it. It's not on their website. MSNBC has not had it on their website. Well, what's the story? Well, the irony here is that anytime Elon Musk has sneezed since he took over Twitter, it's been a story and a headline at CNN and MSNBC. The biggest news that Elon Musk has made was last night, but it's not being reported by CNN or MSNBC. The bombshell of information about how Twitter suppressed the Hunter Biden laptop story ahead of the 2020 presidential election. Elon Musk put out a lot of information last night, and he said he is not done yet. He has teased yet another trove of emails and conversations between Twitter employees that will come out sometime today. Now, in the information, this was laid out last night by Matt Taibbi, who is working with Elon Musk on the story. And there were a series of tweets last night from Taibbi, and here's just some of the highlights. This is number 17. Again, there's a whole series of them. And this relates to the New York Post story. On October 14th, 2020, the New York Post produced Biden's secret emails, an expose based on the contents of Hunter Biden's abandoned laptop, the New York Post. Twitter took extraordinary steps to suppress the story, removing links and posting warnings that it may be unsafe. They even blocked its transmission via direct message, a tool previously reserved for extreme cases such as child pornography. He continued, White House spokeswoman Kayleigh McEnany was locked out of her account for tweeting about the story. That prompted a furious letter from Donald Trump campaign staffer Mike Hahn, who seethed, at least pretend to care for the next 20 days. The decision was made at the highest levels of the company, but without the knowledge of CEO Jack Dorsey. It's made by the former head of legal policy and trust, Vijaya Gadde, playing a key role. They just freelanced it, is how one former employee characterized the decision. Hacking was the excuse, but within a few hours, pretty much everyone realized that wasn't going to hold. But no one had the guts to reverse it. Also, it is mentioned in the tweets that were released last night that the Biden campaign and the DNC would ask Twitter to remove stories and to ban certain people on the site. And there would be responses back from Twitter, quote, handled. Well, Jonathan Turley, so on the Fox News Channel last night, and I always go to Jonathan Turley on stories like this because he has a way of just laying it out very factually, very matter of fact. And here's how Jonathan Turley was looking at it last night.
Well, this has really confirmed some of our worst expectations. You have direct communications from the DNC as well as the Biden campaign, and almost immediate service agreements with Twitter. You know, they send these tweets to be eliminated. They're eliminated within a few hours, and they get back these responses of just handled. And that really captures the problem. You know, all of this was handled. And this back channel has long been suspected. Most of us had little question it existed. But it became even more menacing when this back channel went from being a political ally to the campaign to being an ally to the government in power. Because then it becomes censorship by surrogate. And we've seen that with Twitter, which had this massive censorship system in place. And so when you read these emails, you really see the sort of face of censorship by surrogate, of what would become government officials in some cases, calling upon a corporation to do their bidding, to silence their critics. And the underlying story was very relevant to that election. It was not just about Hunter Biden. It was a scandal involving influence peddling, one of the largest influence peddling scandals in the history of this city. And influence peddling in Washington is a virtual cottage industry.
Right.
But few of us have seen anything like this. And so they killed a story that was directly related to the Biden family and whether they cashed in on access. And it was a close election, and it might have had an impact. But at the end of the day, we have to ask, how far did this go, particularly after the Biden campaign became the Biden administration?
That's Jonathan Turley on the Fox News Channel last night. We're talking about the release of documents from Twitter and Elon Musk. In the documents released last night, they also say, as a social media app eventually regressed from an arena of free expression to a sphere dominated by, quote, tools for controlling speech. Slowly over time, Twitter staff and executives began to find more and more uses for these tools. Outsiders began petitioning the company to manipulate speech as well. First a little, then more often, then constantly. Twitter files showed on at least one occasion the Biden team instructing Twitter employees to remove politically inconvenient content in October of 2020, just weeks before Joe Biden was elected president. Quote, more to review from the Biden team, an email from a redacted Twitter employee said. The message included 5 tweet URLs, thanks all. Another redacted Twitter employee responded, handled these. So that gives you some sense of what was going on during the 2020 campaign. Now, some might say that that's collusion between the DNC, the Biden campaign, and Twitter. Some might say that. Talk about election interference. Well, Marsha Blackburn was on the Fox News Channel yesterday. She was speaking before the release of the documents.
When you look at the content moderators with all the big social media platforms, you look at the way the FBI and the campaign, the Clinton campaign, and then also the Biden campaign went to social media and said, do not put this up. This is going to be Russia misinformation. And now that they see someone exposing what had happened, they're going to go after Elon Musk because he has said he is going to make those files,
yep,
those emails that show this. He's going to make it public.
And he's going to release more of them today. Now, James Woods was on with Tucker Carlson last night. You may recall James Woods, an actor, and he had been knocked off Twitter, apparently at the request of some of the players that we've been discussing. James Woods is not very happy about it, and here's what he had to say last night.
I can guarantee you one thing, more than anything else you'll ever hear in your life. I will be getting a lawyer. I will be suing the Democratic National Committee no matter what, whether I win or lose. I am going to stand up for the rights that every American, not a so-called celebrity.
Right.
I'm not a celebrity. I'm hardly recognizable anymore because my career has been destroyed by these very people. And I will sue, and I'm hoping other people will sue. And if it turns out there are a lot of us on this list where the DNC targeted us, and I will quote the immortal words of Joseph Welch when he attacked Joe McCarthy for the enemies list he had, at long last, sir, have you no shame. President Biden, all of your stocky little operatives in the DNC who have targeted American citizens. Have you, Mr. President, have all of you at last no shame?
And that is actor James Woods reacting to the story from Twitter. Now, ironically, Senator Liz Warren was talking about Twitter yesterday. But not this story, not the interference in the 2020 presidential campaign, not the suppression of the Hunter Biden laptop story. No, she's concerned about Elon Musk at Twitter now, and here's what she had to say.
I think that one human being should not decide how millions of people communicate with each other. And it doesn't make any difference who that human being is. One human being should not be able to go into a dark room by himself and decide, oh, that person gets heard from, that person doesn't. That's not how it should work.
Well, it's not, Senator Warren. And we just laid out for the last 10 minutes how people at Twitter were going into a dark room and controlling what Americans and the world had to hear about what was going on in politics. Interesting. I don't think she intended her comments yesterday to be put in that context. Her attack was on Elon Musk. This story will continue to unfold. As mentioned, Elon Musk will be releasing more documents today, and we'll see what else was going on at Twitter all these years. It's 6:20, and Michelle Murray's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
On the outer loop of the Beltway near Telegraph Road, there is a disabled vehicle. However, looks like that is on the left shoulder, but just use extra caution there. No other incidents or delays reported on the Beltway at this time throughout Maryland and Virginia. So far, everything looks clear on 95 from Dale City and towards Springfield. 395 looking good from Etz Road to the 14th Street Bridge. Earlier accident on the freeway eastbound at the 3rd Street Tunnel cleared, but there is an accident reported in the district on the 9th Street Expressway headed towards Independence Avenue and on New York Avenue at Florida Avenue, so use extra caution there. Now for GarageStoryPair.com, the WML Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Areas of moderate to heavy rain moving through the remainder of the morning hours with a midday lull. High temperatures will be in the lower 60s, tracking a cold front later this afternoon and a few gusty showers. Behind the front, much cooler, only in the 40s tomorrow with plenty of sunshine. I'm 7 News meteorologist Steve Rudin, the First Alert Weather Center.
46 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:21 on the Saturday morning update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
Saturday morning update continues. I'm Rick Fowler, and we will be talking a lot more about this story this morning. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer will join us. John Gizzi will be joining us a bit later on the program. Of course, White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com. We'll talk to KT McFarland. Cheryl Atkinson is with us. Jennifer Harper from the Washington Times. And also coming up this morning, we will be chatting with Jason Greer. He's an expert on labor matters, and we'll get the backstory on sort of the results of all of the rail negotiations. The president taking a victory lap on it, but not quite a win for workers. We'll get into that a bit later on this morning. The irony on the Twitter document release last night, you put it in context with a back and forth between the White House reporter from Fox, Peter Doocy, and the press secretary, Corinne Jean-Pierre. And this is a little back and forth they had late in the week.
When are you guys going to delete the White House Twitter account?
Why would we do that?
Well, you're saying that you're keeping an eye on Twitter because it might not be a suitable platform, so why use it?
Look, I want to be very clear here. The president has always said, and he has been very, very clear in his belief, that it is important of social media platforms to continue to take steps to reduce hate speech and misinformation. And we'll continue to say that.
Boy, when you start to put all of this in contrast to what was released last night, it does get interesting. Here's a follow-up from Peter Doocy.
You say that you're going to be monitoring some of the speech on there. If you see something that you don't like, would you try to shut Twitter down?
So look, you know, when you talk about monitoring, you know, it is, I hate to break it to you, Peter, just like everybody else, we very much monitor the news. We pay close attention to everything that you all are reporting, and Twitter's in the news a lot. And so that's what we're paying attention to.
You know, the funny thing is, the Twitter release of all these documents is not in the news unless you're listening to WMAL this morning or you watch the Fox News channel, because CNN is not covering it. Ignored it for an hour between 5 a.m. and 6 a.m. Not on their website, not on the MSNBC website. Wonder if they'll ever cover the story. Well, another gem in the news this week, of course, Sam Bankman-Fried. FTX cost, what, $60 billion to investors? The money's gone somehow. Maybe they'll recoup some of it. He's been making the media rounds, trying to come out of this looking like an innocent fella that just sort of didn't quite understand. How do you not understand how you're managing billions of dollars of other people's money? Well, here's how he tries to explain it.
Clearly, I made a lot of mistakes or things I would give anything to be able to do over again. I didn't ever try to commit fraud on anyone. I was excited about the prospects of FTX a month ago. I saw it as a thriving, growing business. I was shocked by what happened this month. And, you know, reconstructing it, were there things I wish I had done differently?
This guy sounds like a high school kid who just got caught skipping school. And, Well, he continued to try and explain his way out of it. He was on with George Stephanopoulos on Good Morning America this week. And again, this is Sam Bankman-Fried, who took FTX right down the tubes.
A lot of people look at you and see Bernie Madoff.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that's who I am. Look, there's a question of what happened and why and who did what. What caused the meltdown, and I think that is reads very differently, right? When you look at the classic Bernie Madoff story, there was no real business there. The whole thing, as I understand it, I think was just one big Ponzi scheme, right? FTX, that was a real business.
Not anymore, apparently. Now, you may have heard that Sam Bankman-Fried donated over $30 million to Democratic candidates, one of their biggest donors. Well, he also gave cash to liberal media organizations before they collapsed, and he tried to explain his way out of that one.
It matters a lot, and I want to support good media ventures. That was the whole thesis there, and I don't have, like, governance over any of these. I wasn't looking for governance over them. I was looking to support journalists doing great work because I think what they do is really important, and I think that there needs to be a critical eye on stories.
Two amazing stories that will continue to unfold. 6:27 now on the Saturday Morning Update. In the news at 6:30, Ukraine has won victories on the battlefield against Russia, but is facing a looming challenge on the economic front. The government has been relying on the central bank to print money to cover its huge deficits caused by the war, but tax revenue has fallen. Defense spending has soared for next year's budget. Kiev now looking for ways to pay for its war effort, at least through next year. And there are reports that mail bombs have been sent to various Ukraine embassies around the world, including Madrid in Spain. Most railroad workers were not surprised that Congress intervened this week to block the rail strike, but they were disappointed because they say the deals lawmakers imposed did not do enough to address their quality of life concerns about demanding schedules and the lack of paid sick time. Rail workers face difficult trade-offs that sometimes force them to skip doctor's appointments or miss family events. And the World Cup competition continues today. It is round 16, and it happens at 10 o'clock this morning, the Netherlands facing the USA. And at 2 o'clock this afternoon, it's Argentina versus Australia. 6:32 on the Saturday Morning Update. Michelle Murray's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
Couple of incidents to watch out for on the Beltway. On the inner loop at Georgia Avenue, one right off-ramp is closed due to an accident. And on the inner loop at Telegraph Road, there's a disabled vehicle on the left shoulder of the through lanes, and the reversible right lane is closed, so use extra caution there. In the district, an accident being reported on New York Avenue at Florida Avenue. Earlier accident, though, eastbound on the freeway at the 3rd Street Tunnel, now cleared. A portion of 1st Street is closed in the district between G Place and K Street for utility work. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Areas of moderate to heavy rain moving through the remainder of the morning hours with a midday lull. High temperatures will be in the lower 60s, tracking a cold front later this afternoon and a few gusty showers. Behind the front, much cooler, only in the 40s tomorrow with plenty of sunshine. I'm 7 News meteorologist Steve Rudin, the First Alert Weather Center.
6:33, the Saturday morning update on WMAL.
News Talk 105.9.
WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
It is the Saturday morning update. Thank you for joining us. And Jennifer Harper is a fixture on our Saturday morning program. She writes inside the Beltway over at the Washington Times and WashingtonTimes.com. Good morning.
Good morning, and this is your fixture reporting.
Well, just out of the midterms, and now everybody's all stoked on 2024. There's a lot of advice floating around out there, and you had some advice this week for the Republicans in your column.
Well, there are a lot of people out there that want to advise the Republicans, saying, are you ready for 2024? I don't know if anybody's ready for 2023 yet, but here we go, and it's obviously never too early to prepare for election in this day and age. And a lot of the political sages already have a lot of advice for the Republican Party and their strategy in 2024, and they're very quick to remind the Republicans, you didn't have that red wave you were thinking about, and you got to up your game, and you've only got 2 years to do it. And one of the more interesting advisories came from the Association of Mature Citizens. This is an interesting conservative organization, but they point out that the right conditions, they say, could put Republicans in a position to pick up as many as 11 seats in the Senate. And come November 2024, the Democrats will be forced to defend a whopping 23 incumbent seats, nearly half of their Senate caucus. And this is including a number of vulnerable Democrats in swing states and traditional Republican strongholds. So you see, that kind of lays out the game plan. And so they're saying, though it is, of course, remains unlikely that Republicans will win every single one of the 11 in-place Senate seats and achieve a filibuster-proof 60-seat Senate majority, the fact remains that 2024 presents Republicans with their greatest chance in years to win a decisive Senate majority. So they're kind of saying, are you ready for the challenge? And so here's what they have to say. The party has its work cut out for it before GOP leaders and operatives can get too confident about their 2024 prospects. This year, elections show that conservatives, until they can get serious about finding ways to combat the left's use of mail-in ballots, drop boxes, and ballot harvesting to rig elections in their favors, they will continue to struggle in the key races. So they're saying, watch what they're doing on the other side. But if the Republicans play their cards right and use the next 2 years to ensure they are competing on a level playing field with the left and are selecting strong candidates, November 5, 2024 could prove to be a decisive day for the American conservative movement. Whether the GOP machine chooses to seize the moment and make the most of this key once-in-a-generation opportunity remains to be seen. And again, that's coming from the Association of Mature Citizens. So get with it, GOP.
Okay, so that's the GOP. What about on the left? And, we've heard the term socialist knocked around, progressive. What is the latest on the socialist movement?
Well, here you go. Somebody has gone to the trouble of determining how many socialist candidates we had in federal and statewide elections and how well they did. And they say socialist candidates in federal and statewide elections were overwhelmingly successful in their bids for elected office this year. And in total, Rick, there were 132 socialist candidates, which were tracked, 78 at the state level and 54% at the federal level. And they found that 120 of these far-left candidates were victorious.
Yikes.
That makes it a 90.9% victory rate. And this is a new analysis from the Heartland Institute. This is a Chicago-based think tank. Very smart up there. They do a lot of research, and this is a part of it. And they identified all the socialist candidates by examining their endorsements by people like Our Revolution, which is Bernie Sanders' group, and also the Democratic Socialists of America. They say the average margin of victory for socialist candidates was more than 30 percentage points over the second place finisher, even after excluding uncontested races. This likely indicates that socialist and progressive groups targeted districts during the primaries that they knew Democrats would win easily in the general election, rather than sponsoring candidates and investing resources in races where Republicans were likely to run competitive campaigns. Again, this is coming from the Heartland Institute. They say, overall, the continued success of radical leftist politicians and the replacement of more moderate centrist Democrats is a cause for alarm and should serve as a wake-up call to both conservatives and the more moderate wing of the Democratic Party. And I hadn't really thought about all this, but it seems like that's going to be a dynamic that we might want to pay attention to.
And all that George Soros money doesn't hurt those candidates either. For many people around the Washington area, the congressional calendar is kind of a big deal. You schedule your restaurant vacation times around when the Congress is on vacation. So if somebody wants to get a copy, how do you do that?
Oh, my goodness. That's a great way to put it. I never thought of that. There is a guide to all of that, which is available to everybody. If you would like to find out what the official legislative calendar is for the first year of the 118th Congress, well, it is now available. And here's how you get it. It all comes through the Republican whip, Steve Scalise's office. And you can just go to his website and download it for nothing. So if you want the ultimate guide to lawmakers, or at least when they're coming and going, all you have to do is to go to RepublicanWhip.gov. And there's a nice little icon called 2023 House Calendar right there for you to press, and you can download it right there. So if you're looking for a guide like that, it's for free, and it's through Steve Scalise's office.
So if you're a lobbyist, you can find out when to have those big fat checks ready. President Biden, of course, was going to unite the country, and we haven't quite seen that coming out of the White House. So the question arises, how divided are we? And you have a way to measure it.
Yes, well, this is sort of a dismal poll this early in the morning, but how divided are we? Well, this is how divided it's become, if you're wondering about all the political, just the political discord that goes on all the time. There are some people who won't even share a meal with those who support a political party other than their own. And a major pollster is tracking this trend. That is Ipsos poll. That's an international, global-minded pollster, and they decided to measure how Republicans and Democrats really feel about one another, and their conclusion is Republicans and Democrats remain at odds with one another. They say 58% of Republicans are saying, well, yeah, I could share a meal with someone in another political party, like a Democrat. But only 48% of Democrats would do the same for the Republicans, meaning it kind of sounds to me that nobody wants to sit down for lunch here, but let's move along. And on the other hand, 59% of independents, they remain the most likely to report not sharing a meal with anybody either. So here's what the analysis says. The vast majority of Democrats still feel they have little to nothing in common with Republicans. This is a view that hasn't changed significantly since late September. And Republican attitudes towards Democrats are unmoved, too. And, you know, again, 76% of Republicans say they have nothing in common with Democrats. And moves on to say most independents feel they have little to nothing to do with either party. And that is unchanged as well. 65% of independents feel at odd with those with the another political calling, Rick. And I don't know what to say about all of that, but I think a lot of people have noticed that this acrimony is either strengthening or being more out in the open. But anyway, this is a Ipsos poll of 1,005 U.S. adults that was conducted November 18th, 21st, and through 21st. And released on November 24, so it's very, very recent. Again, Republicans, Democrats won't even have a meal with each other.
You know, sometimes when we see some of the young activists on television, you ask, where do these people come from? And you actually answered that in a column this week.
Are we talking ivy-covered halls here, Rick?
Uh-huh.
Oh, my goodness. Well, our friends at the College Fix, they're another very interesting group. They follow the political callings of college professors and people who do work at our Institute of Higher Learning. And they have discovered that Republicans are a rarity in the land of the highly educated. And this is, again, from the College Fix. They've done a big study from a number of universities. And here's what they found. The College Fix has identified just 61 Republican professors across 65 departments at 7 different universities. And that's all there are. And a total of 33 of the departments had 0 Republican professors identified within them. And that's slightly more than 50% of all the departments surveyed. Again, this is coming from the College Fix. In contrast, 667 professors were identified as Democrats, and based on their political party registration or voting history. Again, 61 Republican professors versus 667 Democratic professors. And when broken into Democrat and Republican, 92% of the professors said they were Democrats, and only 8% identified as Republican. If you're curious as to what schools they studied, and this is a very far-reaching study, they looked at who the professors were at Ohio State, at the University of Nebraska-Omaha, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, University of Georgia, Cornell University, University of Oklahoma, and the University of Alaska at Anchorage. And 6 of the 7 schools are located in states that are considered to be Republican, and with the exception of New York, of course. And all of the universities still show that Democratic tilt. And according to Jen Cabani, she's the editor-in-chief of the College Fix, these results should be another wake-up call that higher education is severely biased and broken.
So what you're saying is the progressive movement only has 61 more Republicans professors that they have to run off campus.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we are approaching year end, and of course that means all kinds of things of the year. And you have the word of the year.
The things of the year. I like that. Oh, yes. Well, I'm looking forward to New Year's Eve and the things of the year. But anyway, yes, we do have a word of the year. This is coming from the esteemed Merriam-Webster Dictionary. The word of the year is gaslighting. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, they looked at a lot of different words at Merriam-Webster Dictionary, and they base their judgment on the number of times words have been looked up by the general public, and the word gaslighting won. And if you don't know about what exactly gaslighting is, it's a term that's been bandied about in the news media and political circles kind of all year, for better or worse. And here's what the dictionary tells us. In this age of misinformation, of fake news, conspiracy theories, Twitter trolls, and deep fakes, gaslighting has emerged as our word for our time, a driver of disorientation and mistrust. Gaslighting is a driver of disorientation and mistrust. It is the act or practice of grossly misleading someone, especially for one's own advantage. 2022 saw a 1,740% increase in lookups for gaslighting, with high interest throughout the year. And you remember the old 1938 type movies? There were quite a few of them called Gaslighting. That's kind of where the public became aware of the word gaslighting. It sort of took off after that. And so anyway, the rationale also noted, in recent years, we've seen the meaning of gaslighting refer also to something that's simpler and broader, the act or practice of grossly misleading someone for personal advantage. The idea of a deliberate conspiracy to mislead has made gaslighting useful in describing lies that are part of a larger plan, and unlike lying, which tends to be between individuals, and fraud, which tends to involve organization, gaslighting applies in both personal and political context. It's at home in formal and technical writing as well in colloquial use, so that's why gaslighting has become the favored word for the perception of deception. Again, this is coming from Merriam-Webster Dictionary, and all of the gaslighting that goes on.
That's everything we always wanted to know about that term. Thank you. That's helpful.
Well, I hope you're not asleep out there already, but that's your gaslighting break for today.
No, that's important because we hear it every 15 minutes these days. Jennifer Harper, Inside the Beltway, The Washington Times. Follow her on Twitter at Harper Bulletin. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a good weekend, everybody.
It is 6:48. It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. Jim Trusty has the weekend off. We will be talking with Jason Greer next. Interesting perspective on the settlement in that rail worker strike. Well, they didn't come out as well as maybe you thought they did. That's next. But first, Michelle Murray's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Silver Spring on the inner loop of the Beltway at the right off-ramp to Georgia Avenue, an accident had closed that ramp. However, everything has been cleared and the ramp has been reopened. Now in Alexandria on the inner loop at Telegraph Road, there is a disabled vehicle blocking the left shoulder of the through lanes and the right lane of the reversible lanes, so do be aware of that as well. Right now, if you're traveling in Fairfax City, watch out for utility work on westbound 50 at 29, and that is currently blocking the left lane. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Areas of moderate to heavy rain moving through the remainder of the morning hours with a midday lull. High temperatures will be in the lower 60s, tracking a cold front later this afternoon and a few gusty showers. Behind the front, much cooler, only in the 40s tomorrow with plenty of sunshine. I'm 7 News meteorologist Steve Rudin, the First Alert Weather Center.
46 degrees in Washington. It's 6:49 on the Saturday morning update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
The Saturday morning update continues. Nationwide rail strike averted this week. And to get it in perspective for us, we are joined by Jason Greer. He is the founder and president of Greer Consulting. It's a labor management and employee relations consulting firm located in St. Louis. He is a former board agent of the National Labor Relations Board, and he is a nationally known expert on the topic. Jason, thank you for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, President Biden has now taken two victory laps, now with the aversion of the nationwide rail strike. He took the first victory lap when they reached a tentative agreement in September, but four of 12 unions rejected the deal. Negotiations failed. And then the president called on the Congress to finish it up and to act. Republicans were angered that they were called upon to vote against workers, but Thursday the vote took place. And on the surface, this sounds kind of generous for the rail employees. They got a 24% pay raise. They didn't get all of the paid leave, but 24% sounds like a lot of money. Put that in perspective for us.
On the surface, 24% increase over the life of a contract sounds phenomenal. But then when you really start digging into the math, you recognize that these railroad companies are making so much money. They're making record profits. I've read someplace where they're making upwards of 1,000% more than they ever have before. So the 24% sounds generous, but it's really not, especially when you consider what four of these unions were really holding out for. And that's paid sick leave, because this is an industry that does not give paid sick leave. They didn't have an increase over the past 3 years. And what's fascinating about the railroad industry versus other industries is that it's an industry that's very much mired in the 60s, where people, from the corporate perspective, they look at these employees like they should just be happy to have jobs. And so they gave them a bunch of overtime because these employees were working during the global pandemic, also known as COVID, and they were working to the point where, yes, they were making more money through overtime, but their bodies were being taxed to the point of breaking, in addition to the fact that they weren't really allowed to be around their families because they didn't have time. So when you talk about the fact that they haven't received a pay increase in 3 years, that's sort of endemic to an industry that I think really needs to be rebooted.
So we as consumers are winners in this because we'll get our holiday gifts on time and we won't have to pay any more than the already inflated prices for everything that we buy. But who are the real losers here?
The immediate losers are the 12 unions that were basically impacted by this, as well as their families. I mean, when you consider that in the contract that was basically forced on them, yes, they're making more money economically, which is great, but they only got one paid day. It's not even a paid sick day. They only got one paid day, and these unions were asking for 15 paid sick days. So it's the workers that are losing, but it's also their families. I mean, when you hear the counts of these family members of these railroad employees who will tell you that they are routinely missing birthdays. They can't go to doctor's appointments because they have to work. They are missing time with their families, but more importantly, they are breaking mentally, spiritually, and emotionally. So it's such a shame that they are losing in the immediate, but I think in the big scheme of things that this is going to cause ripple effects across the public's perception of unions, in addition to the fact that it's going to embolden companies to recognize that we can bargain hard at the bargaining table and we can potentially get what we want because unions may not have nearly as much power as they thought they had, especially in the past 2 years.
Well, that leads to a question I was going to ask you. President Biden, the self-proclaimed most labor-friendly president in history, has now taken this negotiation and thrown it over to the Congress to resolve. So what does that mean next time the Teamsters and management can't come together or another union?
It's ugly. I mean, when you consider all of the organizing, unit organizing that's taken place, especially here in the past 2 years, you look at the fact that public perception, public opinion of unions is higher than it's been in decades, if not the highest that we've ever seen before. The challenge has been, and I've thought about this over and over again, when you look at the mass unionization that's going on with Starbucks, it's one thing to organize, it's another thing to try to get a contract. So when you look at Starbucks, they have no contract. Now contrast that with what's going on currently with the railroad system. You have the self-appointed most pro-union president in the history of this great country who legitimately said, I hear you union members, but we're going to take this to Congress, we're going to take this to a vote, and we are ultimately going to side with the company. This is it's a bad, bad look all the way around.
So what is next for the railway workers here? Is there a cooling off period? Do they come back to the table? Or is this now just a done deal?
It's basically done. It's heartbreaking that it's done, largely because what good is the money that they're going to make if their bodies are so broken down that they can't even spend it, let alone spend time with their families and take care of their overall health? So it's done, and it's a heartbreaking, heartbreaking moment.
And ironically, Ted Cruz and other Republicans joined with Bernie Sanders to support an amendment
right.
that would have provided paid leave time for the railway workers, but that amendment was defeated. So Ted Cruz and Bernie Sanders on the same page. You don't see that very often. Jason Greer, founder and president of Greer Consulting in St. Louis, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Hey, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. It's 6:56 Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. We will have more for you on the release of those documents from Twitter. They started kind of flowing out of Twitter last night about 7:30 or so. And in those documents, a lot of the internal discussions in Twitter during the 2020 campaign, the suppression of the story on the Hunter Biden laptop, the communication between the DNC and Twitter and the Biden campaign and Twitter when it came to getting stories killed and getting people knocked off Twitter. It's fascinating information. Elon Musk has promised more to come out today. We will have more on that story in the next hour here on WMAL.
WMAL FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.